You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. We turn now to censorship in America. The First Amendment grants some pretty strong protections for freedom of speech, but there have been restrictions over time, most notably today, FCC broadcast regulations.
And our next guest says there's a temptation to believe that even a mild form of censorship, like broadcast bleeping, is a curtailment of that freedom. But she says the truth is more complicated than that.
Joining us now is Maria Bustillos. She's a writer based in Los Angeles. Her piece, Curses, The Birth of the Bleep and Modern American Censorship, appeared on The Verge. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Maria, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, pleasure to be here. Thank you.
What got you started thinking about censorship?
Well, I'm a First Amendment fanatic, kind of. You know, being a journalist, it comes up all the time. You know, the idea that you should be able to be free to say what you want, and I've, you know, defended some unpopular writers on all kinds of different subjects, from like pickup artists to like unpopular political viewpoints in my work, because I think a lot of times people are unfairly silenced, or there's an attempt to silence people, and I'm like really like against that. So in talking with my editors at The Verge, we kind of came up with that in itself as like a worthy topic to sort of focus on.
Well, I mentioned the right to free speech, of course, in the First Amendment, but there have been limits on that over time. Why did we start, or when, I guess, did we start to see censorship and issues over blocking what people are saying in American society?
As I wrote in the piece, in 1921, before there was actually a national broadcast network, there were already attempts to silence people on political grounds, because during the First War, the government had taken over what little then existed of radio. And at the end of the war, they tried to maintain monopoly control over it, the Navy, basically, and Congress wouldn't let them. But there was a very fragile concept of public ownership of the airwaves, like who would wind up owning them, whether it would be like a government-controlled thing or whether it would be private industry or whether it would revert to government. So Westinghouse owned a radio station. You know, these radio stations didn't have very much range at that time, but there was still like this really novel thing that a lot of people were interested in. And they were very afraid that if they put a foot wrong anywhere, you know, Congress would take back the right to broadcast. So there was an actress in 1921 named Olga Petrova who was a campaigner for birth control rights. And at that time, there were Comstock laws that were still in effect that forbade discussion or dissemination of any information about birth control. And so she went on the radio and read, you know, kind of lulled her hosts into a false sense of security by saying she was going to read Mother Goose rhymes and of her own, you know, rewriting. And so they're like, yay, fine. This is a very famous actress, a vaudeville actress. She starts reading, you know, there was once an old woman who lived in a shoe. She had so many children because she didn't know what to do. And this was like a hint for people, like as much as she felt like she could get away with saying she was, you know, friends with Margaret Sanger and, you know, had been a campaigner for this. So some people knew what she was talking about, but they completely freaked out. And so that was when a system was devised that in case anything kind of hairy got on the air, the engineer would be able to switch over to a phonograph playing music.
So, and if somebody, and so it was more a political issue then, if somebody came on, I think you mentioned, and started giving pro-communist messages on the air, we might get flipped over to the phonograph.
Exactly.
And later, after the phonograph, we started to hear a distinctive noise. I won't say anything bad, but let's trigger a noise anyway. Okay. We got your laugh over that, too. And it wasn't bleeped out. That's the bleep. What was the birth of the bleep in the United States?
The actual sound has eluded me, I'm sorry to tell you, because there was so much private use of radio. It was definitely at some point in the 1920s, as far as I can make out, at some stage, one of these small radio stations started using this sound, and it became a convention. But I haven't been able to figure out where the very first one was. And I tried. Nobody knew at the Museum of Television, at the Paley Center. I called like all kinds of radio historians, and nobody could help me. So I'll be thrilled if one of your listeners knows.
So it's still a mystery. But at this time, are we still, I mean, it was interesting to hear that, you know, now we worry about getting fined by the FCC. Back then, they're worried about all of radio everywhere being taken away from private hands. Was that still an issue around the time the bleep arose?
I think there, what usually would happen is that people would have their licenses threatened. Mm-hmm. Like, it was pretty fast. Like, by 1927, it was pretty clear that there was going to be, like, a kind of public-private, you know, national radio network that would be overseen somewhat, that there would be some regulation, you know, by government, because there were, at first there were no restrictions, say, like, everybody could broadcast over the same frequency. And there started to be chaos almost immediately as, you know, power started, you know, more powerful transmitters started being invented. There started being real problems. And so it was clear that there needed to be some kind of bureau just to, you know, issue licenses and make sure that people weren't just, like, crazily broadcasting over the same frequencies. So it became, like, in 1927, I think, was, like, the first government, like the precursor of the FCC, happened at that point. And when people got in trouble thereafter, it was individual licenses that were threatened. But, like, over those 6 years, there was a lot of, like, negotiating back and forth, like, between different companies that had different patents on different elements of the technology and government wanting to have a hand in regulating. So it's, there's some really interesting stuff about this. Particularly, I recommend Eric Barnoff on the subject. He has a big, long history of broadcasting, a three-volume one that is just really detailed and really great.
Now, people, we were talking about this as a form of censorship, as, and bleeping as censorship, but you kind of like the bleep, I get the impression. Why is the bleep, if we're going to cut things out, a good way to do it?
Nowadays, what we have is a thing called the dump button, which conceals that there's ever been anything removed from a broadcast. There's a delay. I think it's like 7 seconds or 5 seconds, depending. So if somebody said something that the broadcaster didn't like, it would be removed and the listener would never know that any such thing has happened. My contention is that when there's a bleep, what you're hearing is a discussion. There's a disagreement about, here is something that we consider questionable. And you, the listener, are free to consider why something is being kept from you, what it might be. You have a chance to interrogate, you know, the original performer or speaker, find out what and why. But, I mean, if it's completely hidden from you, you'd never know. And so I contend in my piece that because community standards are the basis of the First Amendment, like what the First Amendment guarantees us is the freedom to decide between ourselves what we consider suitable for public consumption. Nobody wants, you know, like hardcore pornography on some children's station in the middle of the day. Like, these are conventions that society has come up with. These are things that work for us. And it's a little ugly and messy around the edges. Some people disagree. You know, you see a lot of controversy around performers like Howard Stern or people like that who have been given a lot of grief for, you know, pushing the envelope. But basically, there's a conversation taking place. And I kind of do love the bleep as the symbol of that conversation.
But it's hard for, say, a live medium, like, say, a live talk show. We have a dump button here. Our hands are kind of tied. We can't retroactively bleep if we're airing live. If somebody challenges it, what happens on our airwaves? We could pay a bunch of fines to the FCC. What's a live broadcaster to do in that situation?
Well, I'd be really interested to hear, like, your own feelings about the recent decision about fleeting expletives. And, you know, there's a recent Supreme Court decision where the FCC was claiming that they could levy very heavy fines, even for small transgressions against, you know. And the other thing is, the public has to complain, right? There would have to be, like, a huge outcry against you, for instance. But the FCC can't do this by itself. It has to be in response to a citizen complaining. And that is because you have the right to broadcast whatever you want, unless it offends some member of the public. That's the only way that indecency regulations can kick in. So this recent decision said you cannot, the Supreme Court told the FCC, you can't vaguely say any fleeting expletive, I'm just going to go and fine you, without defining exactly what it is that would constitute a real transgression. And, I mean, they're really stuck, in my opinion, because listeners have to be offended by something specific, and the FCC has no control over that. So, you know, I mean, what do you think about it?
I want to, before we take a short break, get to another form of changing words, and this is almost an art form in and of itself, changing movie lines when they go to broadcast TV. Here's a classic piece of American film, Snakes on a Plane, with Samuel L. Jackson as edited for TV. Let's give a listen.
I have had it with these monkey-fighting snakes on this Monday to Friday plane!
Given that it was Samuel L. Jackson, that was not the original script. Does that... Yeah, we've had a lot of fun with that around the office, I got to say, for like the last year. But does that perform the same functions as a bleep? We know that wasn't the original line. Is that a fun way to call attention to what was really going on there, but not play it and risk getting fined for that?
It's actually beautiful because they chose such surreal words. I mean, that would be safe for a child to hear, right?
Right.
And the grown-ups can know what's being said, and the child will just be like, what?
Yeah. It's up there with Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon in the Die Hard movies. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, I talk about that a little bit in the piece, too, how much fun has been had with these conventions over the years, because at the beginning, it very quickly became a subject of comedy. There's a wonderful radio show from 1957. It's a Stan Freiberg piece about, it's called Elderly Man River, where there's a radio censor, and I guess they had like some pretty hardcore ones in the 50s during sort of post-McCarthy years. But the censor is objecting, like, you know, the guy's trying to sing, and it's like, old man, no, you can't say old, that's like really offensive. You have to say elderly. And the whole song is like that, and it's silly and funny. But, like, I mean, even in, you know, the mid-1950s, there was already humor about on this whole topic, and it's the same now. My favorite example recently is from a TV show called Workaholics, where they mixed the kind of words that you had. Like, they were saying clucking, and they're saying, are they saying clucking? They're like, yeah, this is on cable. You know, they're saying, that's why they're saying this, you know, and, like, then they start saying clucking to each other. And then all of a sudden, one of them actually swears, and they bleep it. So
they mix it up, yeah.
Yeah, it's this whole meta comment on, you know, how performers have to move through all these different levels of mediated communication to reach you.
We're talking with Maria Bastias about modern American censorship, and we want to know what you think. Do you view broadcast regulations as a violation of free speech, the bleeps and the changes, or are you glad they're there? Do they make sense in today's society and today's TV landscape, where you can flip to a cable channel and hear whatever they want to put on there? Give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our discussion about modern American censorship, the bleeps and bloops on broadcast radio and TV, with Maria Bastias, who wrote an article on the topic, taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We'll go to the phones now. We have Lynn on the line in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I personally think that censorship belongs at home. Words are powerless in and of themselves, and when an expletive is used, it's an opportunity for a discussion. So that's where I stand. But I think that the funniest rewrite was from The Big Lebowski, when on TBS they changed a phrase to, see what happens, Larry, when you find a stranger in the Alps. That was
subtle but important change there. Well, and you talk about that, the basic idea there, Maria, that it's up to the user. You can turn it off, you can explain to the kids, or you can set rules. A lot of people make that argument.
Yeah, they've been making it since 1924. the same one, and you see the same thing in you know, Justice Brennan in the Supreme Court said the same thing, and it's extraordinary that it's a struggle that's really never going to be over.
All right, we'll go back to the phones. Thanks for the call, Lynn. We've got Dennis with us in New Berlin. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, I'm really enjoying your show. I'm really happy you guys are talking about broadcast-specific censorship. I'm a chief operator at a 10-watt station in Waukesha, and I guess my question, comment, concern is just, you know, you already talked about it on the show already today. So did your guest about how it's really up to the surrounding community to say what obscenity is. And so I listen around to all the different radio stations to find out, like, you know, what I can tell my people at my station, what they can play or not at certain times, but everybody's doing something different. Mm-hmm. But yet these transmitters are reaching in the same range. So I was wondering what your comment would be on that. Why does everybody do it different even though they're all reaching the same people?
Great. Thanks a lot for the call and the kind words. What do you think, Maria?
I think that he's doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing, which is talking about it. I mean, every community has standards which are specific to that community and different people who feel passionately and have ideas to share about it. You know, the more people participate, the better off everybody's going to be and find better solutions so that there's a proper balance struck between people being able to reach their intended audiences and having, you know, enough restraint so that you're not going to offend some people I mean, there's always going to be like a couple of people who are going to be offended probably by almost anything, right? But there's a consensus reached that more or less satisfies everyone, and that's all about participation. I think the caller is doing a great thing by just voicing his opinion. I think that's what we're supposed to be doing.
You know, and we live in a world now where, in addition to the broadcast channels, there's cable where there can be naked people swearing all they want. There's satellite radio where people can say whatever they want. Do you get the sense that the commercial broadcasters are trying to edge up as close as they can to the line, feeling like they have to compete with that?
You know, I didn't get that feeling in my research exactly, because there are some regulations on cable companies. One of the things I did was I went to Comic-Con and talked to some producers and performers in children's television, particularly the animators and producers of a show called Adventure Time, which is on Cartoon Network, because I wanted to know, most of these regulations are to protect children. And people don't want children exposed to what the FCC calls indecency, which, generally speaking, means bodily function stuff, sort of sexual stuff and kind of like excretory stuff. And when I talked with them, they have their own standards and practices offices. All the cable companies have this because there are local regulations on cable companies, even though there aren't federal regulations on them. And they're very, very careful not to cross the line on FCC regulations, particularly where children are concerned, and even when there are just adult programming, because of advertisers. If a lot of people complain to an advertiser about programming that they have found offensive, that will totally reflect on the producers of a TV show and the writers of a TV show. So there's huge amounts of sensitivity, and I think it's done really on the whole more wisely than we are doing it with broadcast TV, where there's an attempt to, you know, exercise control that doesn't necessarily come from the community sometimes. But in the case of cable, they pay very, very close attention to keeping actual people happy, their advertisers, their audiences, parents, you know, and it's very, you know, subtle, careful work that they do. I was really impressed with what I heard from those guys.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Jude with us in Denver. Jude, hi.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you so much for including me in this conversation. It's right up my alley. It spurred my curiosity instantly. I'm a songwriter, and a song that I'm often asked to play at small gigs acoustically or what have you happens to have the F word used in it, and it's actually in its title. And something that I've always found really interesting about how to edit that and how to address that has actually been about context. And as she was just mentioning, these things are usually about the bodily function issues. And so if you're using the F word Usually it's connected to that somehow. Yet the context in my song is about frustration. It's F-I try, and it's about not giving up and feeling that frustration. But the context doesn't matter with that particular word, because that is one of the very few words that's been decided. I don't really care yet what the context is. And so I've just been dealing with that and trying to decide how to address that. And so I wanted to share that, and then I'll just listen to her off there if it's okay.
Thanks, Jude. So, Maria, yeah, that's one of those words where context is nothing.
One of seven. Seven only.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating because it's really quite arbitrary. I mean, actually, George Carlin decided what those seven words would be. He didn't realize it at the time.
That is weird. Yeah, and we watch those very seven words here at the station to this day. Hey, I'm going to play one more little clip from the King's speech as modified for TV. Let's hear
it. You know the F word?
So, you know, would you like to be in a world where we turn on, say, NBC, watch the King's speech, and we hear that bleep free?
I love it both ways, I have to tell you. It's very funny. And it just kind of reminds you, right, that, like, there's someone thinking about this and looking out for it. I don't have, like, a strong feeling that it should end, but it will end, in fact. If the Supreme Court ever visits the right of the SEC to enforce indecency regulations, and I mean, it happened in the print world with Larry Flint and Jerry Falwell, where the Supreme Court said, you know, it doesn't matter if you're very unlimited. Mr. Falwell, you kind of lose, you know, and so it may happen someday that the Supreme Court decides that. You know, the FCC has no right to enforce these things, and then bleeping will end forever.
All right, Maria, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Maria Bustillos is a writer based in Los Angeles. Her piece was Curses, The Birth of the Bleep and Modern American Censorship. We've got a link to that Verge article on our Facebook page.
Coming up next, we'll talk about a reported retaliation plot by Iran against the United States if military action is taken against Syria. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Vera. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.